For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
The unsurpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth. Good morning. For those of you who are not at Ancient Dragon, my name is Douglas Floyd. I'm the temple director and president at Ancient Dragon. Our teacher, Taigen Dan Layton, is not here today, so he asked me to speak partly to kick off our annual spring practice commitment period, which begins in 2 weeks. So I'll begin with a plug for that. The practice commitment period is a chance for us to do a little more practice for over about 8 weeks. There's some additional sitting, some study, and meetings with the teacher, and I think what's equally important, the chance for the participants to meet together more informally, not only to talk about the topic for the practice commitment period, but just to speak with one another about their practice, which is something that's sometimes hard to do in our usual schedule. And for me, there's also going to be the chance to have tea with all of the participants, which will be something I look forward to as well. The theme for this practice commitment period is going to be the Lotus Sutra. We'll talk about 4 chapters of the Lotus Sutra. So I thought I'd speak about a little bit about the Lotus Sutra, just to to kick this off, to introduce the practice commitment period. So what I've done is I've picked one chapter, chapter 4, which is called Faith and Understanding. This is particularly illustrative of what the Lotus Sutra is like. It's different from most other sutras. It's unusual in all kinds of ways. It's very self-referential. It's got stories within stories. It has parables. It has very dramatic scenes. And instead of explaining philosophical doctrines, it's very much about parables or dramatic presentations of the Buddha's awakening. So while it is a scripture that was written between the 1st and 3rd centuries, a long time ago, in a very different culture, I think it's some. And for me, it's been a little bit less foreign than some of the other early Buddhist scriptures. Chapter 4 is a parable, and it comes when the Buddha has just talked to. Hundreds of thousands, millions of other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, Shravakas, Prajnaputras, animals, ordinary lay people, who've all gathered on the Vulture Peak Mountain, which is where the Buddha gave many of his sermons. And he's broken the news to some of his disciples, or to everyone, that, whatever your ideas about Buddhism are and what the path is, whether you've thought all along that you're arhats, who've accomplished everything that you need to accomplish in this life and freed yourselves from delusion. So you're going to die. You're comfortable. You're happy. You're at peace. You're going to die. You're going to enter nirvana. And that's it. I'm sorry to have to tell you, or I'm happy to have to tell you, that that's not what nirvana is. Nirvana is something that's expressed dynamically by a Buddha who comes and lives in this world for the sole purpose of awakening other beings. And the other news is that Buddhas, so the way to become a Buddha is to be a bodhisattva who aspires to become a Buddha and who practices to become a Buddha and to awaken other beings. But the interesting thing is the Buddha only speaks to bodhisattvas, and all bodhisattvas are going to be Buddhas. So he's just told these people who've been practicing all their lives and they've never heard anything before that, well, you've been doing fine, but you're a bodhisattva and you're going to be a Buddha someday. And they're overjoyed and they say, okay, just to make sure we've understood this, here's a story. And we think this is what you've just talked about. So they tell a story that is chapter 4, Faith and Understanding in the Lotus Sutra. And in English translations, it's frequently called the prodigal son, sort of to remind us of the story in the New Testament, although there's not much in common with it in theme. So the story is about a young man and his father in India. The young man decides that he's dissatisfied with things at home and he runs away to make his fortune in the world. And his father is heartbroken. He feels like he's lost his son. He looks for him everywhere and isn't able to find him. And he looks and looks, never finds him. And meanwhile, the son is traveling around. Things do not work out well for him. He does not prosper. So for years and years, he travels around India and he's very poor. He is an itinerant laborer. He's dirty. He's dressed in rags. He's hungry. And when he can't find work as an itinerant laborer, he's a thief. All this time, his father is looking for him. But at the same time, his father, unlike his son, prospers tremendously. He becomes a merchant. He becomes fabulously wealthy. He moves to another town where he can set up his storehouses for all his goods and all the wealth he's accumulated. So he has storehouses and storehouses full of gold and jewels and rich cloth and goods that he's going to sell. And his business extends throughout the known world. All this time then, especially after he gets wealthy, he keeps thinking, where's my son? I've lost him. How am I going to pass on my wealth to him so that it can be maintained? So you can, the parable is kind of clear that the father's the Buddha and the son is us, and his wealth is the Buddha's wisdom and awakening. And the interesting thing is that, right, that that for a Buddha being awake and at peace, being wise, fearless, compassionate, it's not enough. He has to pass on his understanding. So the father continues to feel this way and grieve for decades. And so after the son has been wandering in this way and suffering this way for decades, the sutra says maybe even 50 years, the son comes to this town. And he's not expecting it, whereas it turns out his father lives, although he doesn't know that because his father's moved to a new town. And he comes up to a huge estate. And there, his father has set up sort of the equivalent of a court. And we used to have the same thing even through the Renaissance in Western Europe, where wealthy people would set come out every day and wait for retainers and people who wanted to speak to them, to let them know things or ask for favor, would come to speak. So the man's father had done that. He'd come out and he was dressed up in all the finery of a fabulously wealthy merchant. So he's wearing rich textiles, and he's got jewels, and he's sitting on what's very much like a throne that's got more elaborate textiles and pearls and gems, and there are flowers everywhere, and incense and perfume is being sprayed in the air. The father's getting ready to speak to everyone who's gathered in this huge assembly of rich people, ordinary people, poor people, and the son comes to the front gate. And the son sees this, and he's stunned. He doesn't recognize his father. It's been 50 years, and his father wasn't wealthy back then, so it's not too surprising. But when he gets there, he looks at himself, and he's ragged, he's dirty, he's a vagrant, and he goes, "Oh my God, if they see me, they're going to catch me, they're going to think I'm a thief, and they're going to throw me in jail and punish me. They may even turn me into some sort of serf, where I'll be working the rest of my life without any sort of compensation." So he's getting ready to run away. When his father looks up and recognizes him out at the front gate immediately, so the father turns to two of his attendants and he says, "You see that man over there? I want you to get that man and I want you to bring him here." So that you can sort of imagine that maybe these were guards or something, big hulking guys. So they go catch the son and they grab him by the arm and say, "Come with us." And they drag him into the estate and bring him up to his father. And the son has panicked. He's absolutely sure that they're going to imprison him and punish him now. So they bring him in front of his father, who he still doesn't recognize, and he faints right there. And the father says, "Okay, he's not ready for the news yet that he's my son." So he says, "Let's throw some water on his face, wake him up, tell him he can go." So they do that. They wake him up and say, "You don't worry about it. You're okay. We're not going to do anything to you. You're free to go wherever you want." And the son leaves, and the father immediately turns to someone else and says, "Okay, I want you to change your clothes, put on some dirty clothes, and I want you to go find that man, and I want you to tell him that you've got a job for him back here at the estate." And you figure out what that's going to be. So the man does. He catches up to the son. He says, "Look, you seem like a nice guy. We could use you around the estate. We've got a job for you. We'll pay twice the usual wage if you'll come back." And the son says, "Well, that sounds pretty good." And he comes back to the estate. He asks for an advance on his wages, which he gets. And then he starts his new job, which it turns out, unfortunately, is cleaning out the dung from the stables and emptying the latrines. But he hasn't had work for a long time. He hasn't had any money. He hasn't had much to eat. So this is good for him. So he starts working and does a good job, doesn't complain, doesn't cause trouble for the other workers. And the father, from time to time, takes off all the rich clothes and puts on ordinary clothes and wanders down to the stables to talk to the foreman just to keep an eye on his son. And so he'd come down and, you know, he'd see his son, and the whole thing, he would be saying, "You guys are doing a great job," or, "Hey, you know, it's not break time. Let's get going." So the son keeps working and working. This goes on for a long time. And the father finally comes down, gets to know him. And they talk, they get to know each other, they get comfortable with each other, they start to trust each other. Finally, one day, the father says, "You know, you're like a son to me. And I want you to stay here. You're doing a fabulous job. You're an ideal employee. I'm going to give you a lot more. It's a place to live. I'm going to furnish it for you. Going to increase your wages. Keep it up." And leaves. And then the son continues that. But where he's always felt like a failure in his life, he's been this vagrant who's never accomplished anything, who's not good for anything. He's been doing a good job and he's received this recognition. So he's starting to feel pretty confident in the way things are, and that he can take care of this job and any additional responsibilities that are coming. This has gone on for 20 years. And the father finally comes back to him and says, "You know, I'm getting old. You're doing a great job. I want you to stop cleaning out the stables and emptying the latrines. I want you to come help me. I want you to manage my storehouses full of jewels and gold and textiles and all the wealth that I have. You're going to be responsible for whatever goes out, whatever comes in. You're going to learn the whole business. From now on, there's not going to be any difference between you or me in running my affairs. Just make sure that there aren't any foolish losses. So the son accepts the job. He's become pretty self-confident. He's confident he can do this. And he does. He starts running the business. He learns what there is to be learned. And he has free run of the estate, and he can go in and out of his father's house, but he's still living off the estate and still feeling like, even though he's confident, he's learned to do this, he's learned a lot about what it means to take care of the wealth of his father and how you would maintain it, how you would run this business. He's still, you know, he's still an outsider. This isn't his. But finally, his father, who's now over 90 years old, gets sick. And he says, okay, this is the time to break the news. And he brings all of the retainers from his household in. He brings his son and he says, well, this is what's happened. I used to live in another town. I had a son. My son ran away. I couldn't find him. I came here. I became wealthy. And one day, my son showed up and I gave him a job. He did great. He's been running my business. This is my son. I'm really his father. This is my son. Now all of my wealth belongs to my son. And he understands everything about my business. And the son just says, well, he's stunned. And he recognizes this is true. And the story ends with him saying, well, without any intention or effort on my part, these treasures have come to me by themselves, and that's the end. So, the story has been interpreted different ways. And in fact, in the sutra itself, it has, it's part of the message, one of the principal messages of the sutra, that despite all the divisions and different phases of Buddhism, out of using skillful means to bring everyone to awakening, the Buddha has given teachings to people that are appropriate to what they're ready to receive. So he taught people about, you know, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and dependent goal arising and that sort of thing, and taught them that, well, if you learn all of this, then you will wake up and you'll get rid of all these delusions and you'll enter nirvana. But when they were ready, he started talking about bodhisattvas, and he eventually, as part of the Lotus Sutra and the sermons on the Vulture Peak Mountain, he breaks the news that, well, even if you don't know it, you really are a bodhisattva and you're going to be a Buddha. And you can see in the story the whole progression of things going along with the son, and he doesn't know what's going on, but he's going to inherit his father's wealth. And Tiantai Buddhism sort of ran with this story and he made it even more elaborate and said, well, okay, this set of sutras belongs to this phase, and this set of sutras belongs to this phase, and this set of sutras belongs to this phase. So, that's fine. I mean, I really myself think of this differently. The Lotus Sutra is very much not about complex categories of things, like other sutras and philosophical theories. You know, if you read the Avatamsaka Sutra, for example, it's just list after list after list of stages in a bodhisattva's path, the different bhumis and all the different things that the bodhisattva at each phase there has to perfect. So at each level, there's 10 of this and subcategories of 10 under that and subcategories of 10 under that. And that's not what the Lotus Sutra is all about. The Lotus Sutra is about, it's about inspiration and encouragement and presentation of what awakening really would be. And you can see that what the story of the prodigal son is not a story about this son who's, you know, he's been poor, he's been wandering around, he comes to this household, doesn't recognize his father, but you know, he works hard and really practices very hard and gains all sorts of virtues and understandings of the path and has a gigantic breakthrough, and now he comes and he's wealthy himself. And so he has all of this wealth of enlightenment and understanding. He's now a Buddha because he's worked really hard and gotten there. Or he's done all this and his father says, "You're a pretty good guy. Here's some, you're just like a son. Here's my wealth. You're a Buddha too now." It's completely different from that. It's a story about someone who is wealthy when he comes to his father's house. But he's not prepared to recognize that. And his father, the Buddha, is prepared to present him with a way of growing until he is ready to accept the news that he's a Buddha. It's very much like, I think that our sutra opening verse is from the Lotus Sutra, right? That we, our job is to accept and maintain the Dharma. And what we do, what the Lotus Sutra is trying to do, is to get you to accept and maintain the truth that you already, as a matter of your birthright and your inheritance right now, are wealthy, that you possess the wealth of understanding, compassion, powers, fearlessness of the Buddha, when you're ready to accept that and acknowledge it. That's a very different thing, that our practice is not about building up some sort of spiritual strength or capability. We're there now if we can accept it. But we don't, so we practice. And you can see the stages in the story that are reflecting what our practice is like. You know, we sit down to meditate. We come to Buddhism because we have this sense of impoverishment, right? Something's missing, and we come for meaning or because there's a hunger for something, and maybe meditation will fulfill that. And I think shoveling shit is a pretty good description of what it's like for a long time sitting on your cushion, and all these thoughts are coming up and these emotions, and it's just whirling and whirling and whirling, and you just kind of shoveling it out as you come back over and over and over again. Okay, here's my breath. Breathing it again. I'm gone. Okay, shovel that out. And cleaning. You know, Buddhism has images all about cleaning out the attachment and aversion and the thoughts that come from that. So the son, you know, the son immediately, you know, as soon as he came to the estate and starts shoveling the shit, immediately gets a fabulous salary, double what you would ordinarily get. And his father comes down, and as he continues to work and become more comfortable with doing the job and gets good at it, there are even more benefits that he gets. So while the message is that to become a Buddha, nothing has really changed other than the fact that you've recognized and acknowledged your own Buddhahood. While that is waiting and you're practicing, there's still these benefits occurring. And there's an awakening there, right? I mean, we wake up, we're in the middle of this, we're shoveling the shit, and the thoughts are coming, and we're lost and caught up in anxiety or thoughts, feelings. But we keep waking up over and over and over again. And this is also part of the Buddha's awakening. is just like the son who's taking care of cleaning the stables, cleaning the latrines. That's part of maintaining that estate. That is really part of his father's work, of maintaining this wealth and supporting it and keeping the estate going. This really is the Buddha's work and the Buddha's awakening. But this next phase that really, I think, pretty clearly is supposed to be an example of, okay, you've been practicing for a while, now you're opening up, and the relief from anxiety and delusion and attachment and aversion and this attempt to escape from the sense of impoverishment and anxiety and dissatisfaction with life is followed by, as you've practiced, more of a sense of space and seeing through our attachments and our thoughts becomes more a matter of extends off the cushion. And it's not that we just see through our anxiety and negative thoughts and painful feelings off the cushion, but that there's becomes a more active role in which we start leading a compassionate, generous, kind life, a nurturing life with other people, and our own. We start to embody the awakening in our actions. This is the real Buddha work. This is what Buddhists do. It's interesting that in the story, you know, the son is given the job of managing the storehouses, and his father says, "We're not different anymore." And the Lotus Sutra is clear that the bodhisattvas, when they practice and they help other people and they preach the Dharma, they're doing the Buddha's work. There are trillions of Buddhas in the universe of the Lotus Sutra, and they are all surrounded by masses of bodhisattvas who are doing the work of the Buddha, preaching the Lotus Sutra, and helping other beings. And that's the interesting thing, that the son learns to do everything that his father does to maintain the wealth and create more wealth. And he becomes a Buddha when his father tells him, you know, this has been yours all along. That this work you have done hasn't been for me. It's been in support of your own awakening. It's been the expression of your own awakening and the expression of your own wealth. And I think that's an important practice point, that we don't do this, or a different way of approaching our sitting and our practice of the paramitas and the precepts, is that we're not doing this in order to have something good to us happen to us, so that we're going to escape from suffering or that we're going to come to some awakening, but that the generosity of the practice of the precepts and the practice of waking up from our own deluded thoughts and emotions is itself just recognizing over and over again that we've been deluded and we're awake now and we can help other people and deal with them from a sense of generosity and compassion. I think that's the inspirational message, that awakening is here if we only claim it, and that our attempt to awaken is itself an expression of that awakening. And I think It's a cultivation of awakening. That's something that we don't talk about in Zen very much. That we cultivate these virtues and we cultivate our awakening. But that is the case, that we wake up and we encourage it. And we grow as we awaken more and more and more, to until we finally are able to claim our inheritance of being awake, and then continue to manage the estate and to help other people. So I think I will leave that there for now and see if anyone has any thoughts. Has anyone read this story before? That's right, you've read the Lotus Sutra, okay. Stephen has. This is not one of the stories we'll talk about. We will be talking about some more dramatic stories, where we'll talk about chapter 2, where the Buddha gives this. I'm gonna try not to steal too much of Taigen's thunder when he introduces the Lotus Sutra. But we'll talk first about chapter 2, where the Buddha gives this news that Buddhas only give the teaching to bodhisattvas, and all bodhisattvas are going to become Buddhas. And whatever you think you've been doing in your practice, don't worry about it. You can't get it wrong. You're on your way. You are the heir to awakening, and you will receive that inheritance. It's a big change. The other chapters we will talk about are ones that Taigen has written about extensively in one of his books that's available in the library, that are presentations of what awakening is like. The idea that chapter 11, where the Buddha is joined, Shakyamuni Buddha is joined by a Buddha who's already died and been mummified, but when the Buddha starts talking about preaching the Lotus Sutra, this mummified Buddha reappears in a giant stupa that floats in the air, and Shakyamuni and everyone on the Vulture Peak Mountain lifts up in the air, and Shakyamuni sits next to the Buddha and presents more of the teaching. And then there's the chapter in which Buddhas and bodhisattvas from all throughout all the universes in whatever, the cosmos, appear and come to the Vulture Peak Mountain and offer to help the Buddha in preaching the Lotus Sutra and awakening the people here in our world. And the Buddha says, no, that's not necessary. And all these bodhisattvas start springing from the earth. Previous chapter and in that chapter, and then in the next chapter we'll talk about the Buddha gives this amazing news that he's already been a Buddha for trillions of years, and then he just appeared to be born as a young prince in India, and that when he dies he'll just appear to die, that he's really has an inconceivably long lifespan. That there's a reason for him appearing and then seemingly dying, passing from the world. And this is a chapter that's in our chant book and that we chant from time to time. But they are very interesting chapters. So if you haven't signed up for the practice commitment period, I urge you to do it. I think it will be worthwhile. Anyway, thank you. Thank you. Self-worth that came with it, of marijuana that he was fed and clothed.
mm-hmm. and the sense of self-worth and dignity that has come to this cast of people that are outcasts truly in India, and a sense of self-worth and pride and self-respect that came and has opened themselves up to the Dharma.
Yeah, and I think that excuse me. Historically, that's been part of, I think, the clearly part of the popularity of the Lotus Sutra, this message that all of us are sons and daughters of the Buddha and heirs to the Buddha's awakening, and therefore all of us are important, is a message that has had tremendous importance in popular religion in East Asia, sometimes even political importance. And I think part of the popularity of the sutra is that part of the message is clearly that leading the bodhisattva life is leading the Buddha life, but there isn't the same, although it's clear that the Buddhas, like all bodhisattvas, practice the paramitas and the bodhisattva practices. The Buddhas meditate and they practice the perfections. Just living this kind, generous life is an expression of awakening there, independently of meditation practice. And that, therefore, everyone in helping others selflessly is embodying the Buddha and the Buddha's awakening. It's an interesting difference from the focus in most of the Zen school, but I think it it lends itself to an interesting experiment when you're sitting on your cushion that this isn't what we're doing isn't some sort of exercise to generate a state of mind. It's living on the cushion, just sitting and breathing, just like life off the cushion. And the point is to just be open and awake and expressing that awakening here rather than to generate some state that we consider awakening. I think it's worth trying.
It is very inspirational. It seems to be a lot different than the kind of teaching poems, the big knees are squished in my head, and the whole idea of that we're not sitting to achieve anything. It seems like he did give a lot of stuff. I mean, he might not have been intending to. You know, it's just it's inspirational and more so than other things I've heard.
Yes, Jerry.
I'm struck by you can't do it wrong. I have to squirm on when I say, well, it's still a good advice. No, just go by it. And so it's comforting to know, you know, you can't do it wrong. It's just do it. Whatever happens, you are what you are.
Yeah.
Somehow, you know, there's no special technique, or there's no special.
Well, it's kind of an interesting perspective, too, that this message that someday you will be, you already are the heir to this awakening. And someday it will be, you will realize it fully. This whole idea of sort of looking ahead, looking back. Someday I'll look back at this and say, this is how I woke up. I'm somebody who is going to wake up. I'm somebody who wakes up now. Is an inspirational message. It definitely creates a change in perspective about who we are. As we're not some spiritual failure. We're someone who's already wealthy and who will recognize that at some point. And come into our legacy.
Thank you.
We have a lot of karma.
Yes.
You know, I think because of karma, the way our minds work, and I think at this stage of the world, we can see karma in broader ways than even medieval India did. But it's clear that we have strong tendencies to see, to feel and approach the world through a sense of neediness and defensiveness. And at the same time, I don't think, you know, the delusion about ourself and the way the world is organized is not really a philosophical idea so much as a sense that we are separated from the world and we are alone, and so everything that happens to us, everything around us, and all the people around us are in some way going to satisfy our neediness or injure us or take something away from us. And so we don't recognize who we are because we that's who we are. We feel unworthy, we feel threatened and impoverished. And we have to be taught to recognize that there's another way, and that we experience that. And, you know, we experience awakening even before we're taught to do zazen. We just don't recognize it because no one's really pointed it out to us that you're awake. You don't feel this way right now. You're not caught up in this kind of attachment and aversion. I think that's it. But, and, you know, even after you're taught that that's the way our minds work, even after we learn to sit, even after we start to settle down some and our minds open up a little bit, there's still plenty of fear and anger and hunger and all the rest of it going on. But the interesting thing is that we can learn to wake up even while that's going on. But I think and part of the practice is in recognizing our inheritance of awakening is when we figure out that we didn't cause ourselves to wake up. It wasn't that at some moment we said, oh, I'm going to wake up. You woke up and you said, oh, I woke up. At that moment, you can nurture it by saying, okay, well, I'm awake. I'm going to stay here for a while. And you will for a little while, and then you'll disappear again. But over and over again, Zazen is about recognizing that inheritance and recognizing our awakening. And then we lose it, and we come back over and over again.
I feel that it's part of that process. For something about that process is important for the awakening. Just like his son had to go through the different stages of working to realize the well. And I feel sometimes it's not just that process of sitting and what goes on when we sit, but then going out into the world and seeing how we respond to all the things that are going on around us and realizing our inherent part in all of it. What I'm trying to say though is that internal process of doing that is, he says that's okay, like it's supposed to be that way. You know, and I think oftentimes we feel like if it's difficult we must be doing something wrong. Not only on the cushion, but just in general in our lives. And the Buddha says in the story that even if it's difficult, that's part of the process, in a sense. It's just the way it's supposed to be, because somehow that tension or that questioning or that stripping away is inherent in all of this.
Yeah. I think, you know, a huge part of the Lotus Sutra is the teaching about skillful means, that the Buddha teaches according to, teaches someone where they are and teaches what they're prepared to hear and receive and what will lead them to awakening. And that will change over time. But sort of the flip side of that is no matter what the Buddha teaches, and part of Soto's Zen is that they will teach you, you know, there's already this awakening. There's nothing to be done. You're just sitting here expressing your awakening. We only, you know, it's not, in one sense, it's we're taught what we're able to receive, but another way of looking at it is whatever we're taught, we receive what we're ready to receive. So, I mean, you've definitely heard someone after a Dharma talk say, oh, yeah, so this, and you go, no, that's not it. But it's not really wrong exactly, but that's not what that is. And but that's part of it, that we're not failures. We're not even really beginners. The fact that we recognize that something's wrong and perhaps there's something we can do about it and come here means that's a big step. So the growth has begun. So we can't be failures. We are growing.
Or that we have to experience our own aha moments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we don't, even like the Buddha said, it's all here for you, and I'm telling you it is. But if you don't experience the aha moment, you're not going to believe me, or you're not going to accept it as your own.
Yeah. In that story, you have to wonder, what if the father had told him? And you have to suspect that the son was so frightened and felt so unworthy of it, and it felt like such a failure, he would have said, this is some sort of trick, I have to get out of here. And I think, you know, that's one of the things it's kind of interesting about a place like Ancient Dragon. There are people come who are not at all interested in Buddhism, and there are people who are very interested in Buddhism, and you have to sort of figure out how do you talk about these ideas in a way that doesn't really turn people off. I mean, if someone's coming because they're very anxious and they want to learn meditation in order to calm down and feel a little more serene, I don't know that it's all that helpful to sit down and say, well, you know, you're going to be a Buddha, and this is what, and, you know.
You're
going to
help all these other people.
Yeah, it's a kind of, well, okay, you know, are they going to come back if you do that?
The other thing is true, and this is particularly about people that I work with, you know, people who would, you know, don't even know what it is, or when you say what it is, but when you don't, so often they teach you things that they have put us to, you know, that they have that sense of compassion and charity, and you know, and they even, you don't have to be
yeah.
It's almost natural for them. Easy for them. I know people like that.
Sure. Well, if everybody has that inheritance of the awakened mind, then everybody is going to express it. You have to deal with other people expecting that they're going to express their awakening. Yeah.
I think I maybe told this before here, but now it reminds me of it, that Sandra Barnes, is a teacher in the San Francisco area, talked about using her practice. She went through cancer treatments, and she had to go to the public hospital there, which she had recovered. And one time when she was lying on a gurney in the hallway for hours, as she often did, she decided she was going to really open her eyes to the people she encountered who were bodhisattvas. And it was so awakening. That she was able to recognize the concern, the care for her in the midst of this very frantic, busy hospital.
Maybe we have time for one more comment, if anybody has one. or not. Good. Okay.